I've always believed the ambition of every band, whether they were some super grassroots punk rock band or some well-groomed major label band, was to become the biggest band in the world. One can feign modesty, but in the back of everyone's mind, that's what all bands are working towards. Whether they achieve it or not is another thing entirely. And this shouldn't be looked on with disdain, it's rather quite admirable. But when a band starts to gain some momentum outside of their backyard and graduate from becoming a quote-unquote regional band, a couple of things happen. Firstly, you become the default representative of your city, your country, even if said city or country or you yourself would prefer you not to be. Secondly, the scene that spawned you, that nurtured you, and helped you ultimately sprout wings, helped you cut the cord and leave the nest, so to speak, will eventually forget about you and move on while you slowly continue turning your hobby into your vocation. It's a classic case of out of sight, out of mind. And after 15 years of solid touring abroad, the Toronto scene that I once knew is no more. Don't get me wrong, it's still very vibrant and its bands are world class, but my kinship with it has lessened substantially. I see it as fallout from meeting the objective of what every band is kind of supposed to do. Still, I need a hometown fix from time to time. Something or somebody that reconnects with home when I'm away for weeks and months on end. Thank God for social media, texting, and Skype. But every now and then, I'll find it via a fellow Torontonian out on the road, someone who shares the same background, experiences, reference points, and similar viewpoint. Sometimes, and I mean only sometimes, they also happen to be in a band. That's what happened when I met up with Chris Slowrack, bassist of the band Metz, when we were both far from home playing the Southside Festival in Germany together this past June. Whether people know it or not, at home, we rehearse just a few doors down from Metz, and all last year, we were the only bands in the rehearsal building during the day jamming and writing our respective records nearly side by side, stopping to talk to each other in between breaks. Now that their Metz 2 album and our Fire Music album have been released, it was only a matter of time that our paths would eventually cross again out on the road. Metz are a band that took me by surprise, and if I'm not mistaken, helped usher in this recent noise rock revival. As someone who lived and breathed that scene back in the day, I'm glad bands like Metz exist, and I'm glad people have taken to them as much as they have. It's nice to see a band that I really like from my hometown move beyond the coddling of home turf and do it and just kill it. When Nick Flanagan and I record podcasts together, I'm always on Nick's case to avoid scene talk because I feel it bores an audience unfamiliar with our local scene being discussed. I've had to edit out whole discussions that I felt most people couldn't follow, even if they were from Toronto, because it got so inside. I say this to preface an apology, because when two guys from the same scene, thousands of miles from home, meet up like Chris and I did on this episode, talk can and did tend to get pretty regional. But I kept a lot of it in because I think it's interesting and shows that no matter where we're from, we all have similar origin stories, so sorry, and sorry to Nick. Okay, before we start, and although it doesn't make sense right now, I just wanted to make a footnote here and say the band Ghost that I reference in the podcast episode from Japan were on Drag City Records, not K Records. The God's Head Silo record Chris and I discuss is called Share the Fantasy. And I wanted to give a shout out to Boris Castellanos, who I used to work with, and brother of Jaime, who we mention here, and who are both in a band called Project 9. It'll all make a little more sense when you listen to the episode. I want to thank Blue Mic Microphones and Skull Candy Headphones for the support of the podcast. I want to thank Chino Loco's Restaurants, because when I want a fish burrito, I want it stuffed with chow mein noodles. And thank you for listening. If you do feel inclined, please leave a rating and or a review on iTunes, because it ups the podcast's profile. Here we go. Chris Slowrack of Metz is on this episode of the official Danko Jones podcast, and it starts now. The Danko Jones podcast is the best around. Nick Flanagan is Danko's co-host. Cool. Hello for free. I'm so glad I like to sometimes.
Jimmy in from fucked up. Stop playing. Hang down. I got to know Danko a few years ago when I used my vacation time to follow the band on the road. And I even spent a day with Danko in some European town that escapes me. But we ended up talking about 17th century art, his pet rock collection, the summers he spent as a teenage air traffic controller, his venomous snake collection, his passion for planking, and the night he spent with Ringo Starr's housekeeper. He's a fascinating character with a wealth of stories to share. And I'm a huge fan of Danko, but a bigger fan of his stories.
Danko Jones has a podcast. It's called the Danko Jones Podcast. La da 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 da.
Hey, Chris. Thanks for coming on the podcast in the back lounge of our bus. And we just kind of played together. You can call that playing together, right?
Yeah. Yeah, we were separated by one band, but they don't really count anyway. Yeah. So, yeah, it was like the Danko Jones Metz show today.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, Southside, a festival in Germany. And I thought you guys... It's the first time I've seen a full show of you guys. I thought, I was very impressed. You guys are awesome. I mean, I have the record, the first record. I still have to get the second one.
We can help you with that.
Yeah. And, I mean, you know, usually with bands that are hyped, I kind of go, ugh. And then I heard your record and everything. You know, I spoke to Bruce Pavitt about you guys.
Yeah, you were telling me about that the last time I saw you. I had never met him, and we met him at the Sub Pop Jubilee.
Mm-hmm.
And, he said a lot of really nice stuff to us about our band, and we were really touched. The whole Sub Pop thing's always been like a bit of a... Every time we meet like someone that we sort of respected over there, and they're like, "Yeah, we really like your band," we're always just sort of like... Never really thought it would get to that point, you know? So we meet a dude like Bruce Pavitt. He has like a deep history and with that label. It was pretty amazing that he was so stoked on our band.
Yeah, I mean, that is definitely someone of note. If that kind of person likes you, you know you're probably doing something right. But how did it go from you forming your band to getting on Sub Pop? You guys are based out of Toronto, but you're not originally from Toronto, right? How did you guys form?
I'm from just outside of Toronto. I grew up in Oshawa. Yeah, then I moved in with my father in Toronto when I was about 12. And I've been in Toronto ever since. And the other two guys in the band, they grew up in Ottawa and moved to Toronto, I'd say close to 10 years ago now.
Is there a Monin connection with you guys?
Yeah, I used to play in that band.
You used to be in Monin.
Yeah, when I was like 19.
So we played a show together. We played with you guys once in St. Catharines.
St. Catharines? Yeah, probably.
Outside of the Mind Bomb.
Was that with the Black Angels?
Black Halos.
Black Halos, that's
yes.
Right. Yeah, yeah.
In 2001.
You know, every time I see Rob from the Black Halos, we always talk about that show. Because that was the first time I ever met that guy, and he's such a sweet dude. I don't know if you know that guy. I think he was in Sparkmarker back in the day.
Oh, I know Sparkmarker back in the day,
yeah,
for
yeah,
sure.
Yeah.
I have a few 7-inch Sparkmarker 7-inches.
Yeah, me too.
Because I really dug Monin. I thought you guys were really, really great.
I just did that first full length. That was my only involvement with that band. And it was
That's the one I had of you guys. And I thought you guys were great. So from Monin dissolving, you hook up with these two guys.
Well, I left Monin / got kicked out of Monin, and they continued on. But I played in a bunch of other bands, and then eventually, I'm 36 years old. So between Monin and this band, there was like a good 9 years, maybe. So... I played in like a metal band called the Abandoned Hearts Club with a bunch of friends of mine. We signed with Century Media and then dissolved before we even put out a record.
Oh, wow.
And then after that, I was sort of finished for a little bit, and I took about 3 years off. And I met Hayden through a mutual friend, and he had already started Metz with Alex in Ottawa, but they had just moved to Toronto, and the bass player hadn't come with them, so... We were at he invited me over to his house for a barbecue, which I thought other people were going to be at, but apparently, no, it was just me. I thought it was going to be, you know, sort of like a party type situation. But anyways, I showed up and we had a barbecue, just the two of us, and we hit it off and we've been, you know, really close friends ever since. But at that barbecue, we decided that, you know, we'd play some music together and see how it went. Mm-hmm. And ever since then, we've been Mets. And that's just, that's the way the band sort of really kind of formed into what it is now.
How did you guys go from forming this band to getting on one of the most notorious slash prestigious indie rock labels of all time? Like, oh, that's based on the other side of the continent.
So, I have friends who play in that band, the Constantines. Mm-hmm. They're very close friends of mine. And through the Constantines, I met this guy, Chris Jacobs, who's the general manager of Sub Pop. And I had been doing some work with the Constantines at the time. And Mets made our first 7-inch. Just, you know, we weren't going to make anything. And John Drew was like, I have to record your band. Come record with me. So we recorded 4 songs, which ended up being our first 2 7-inches. So we put out the first one, and I think it was Steve from the Cons sends it to Chris Jacobs. And then we recorded, like, we put out the second one. I think he sent it over to Chris Jacobs. And then we got the third one done. I was really proud of the third one because it was actually Negative Space, which ended up on our first record, and kind of a weird song called Automat. And I sent it to Chris just with like a note being like, hey, I'm pretty sure you've heard our band, but I don't know. I'm just sending you this on with the chance that you might actually give it a listen. And he gave it a listen, wrote me some nice words back, and that was that. So we were sort of building a following in Toronto. We had been playing a whole lot of shows and doing a lot of stuff at that place, Parts and Labor, and it got to the point that when we played that place, there was always like a big, huge lineup. It would completely sell out, and the shows were manic and crazy and fun. And I always like to say that the sign that things are going well is when you have a mosh pit in front of the stage and it's all girls. Like, it's changed a lot for us since then, like 99% dudes at all of our shows now. But if you have a show and your entire mosh pit is girls, you're definitely going to bring out a whole bunch of guys as well.
Oh,
right?
Yeah, yeah.
So our band was doing real well because we had a full mosh pit full of girls.
What year was this? Because, I mean,
this would be 5 years ago, four or 5 years ago.
Right. We're, you know, being growing up in Toronto, being part of the scene, now that we tour all the time, I cannot say that I'm part of the scene anymore.
I think we're sort of in the same situation, right? Because we play Toronto maybe once a year, if that.
Same here, yeah.
And when I'm home, I try and get out and go see stuff, but I'm a married dude. I like to spend time with my wife as well. So in the process, I mean, I run that site in Toronto, Just Shows, with Mark Pesci. And I think that thing keeps me...
Mark Pesci?
Mark booked Parts and Labor, and I think Mets played Parts and Labor more than any band. We played that place all the time, and it was great because it was a small basement, and it could get wild, and everybody always had a really good time, and it was easy to pack it, and it just, you know, it built up to this thing, and then eventually we couldn't really do that anymore. It ended up going to a bigger room. So in the process of all of that, we had written a whole bunch of songs. We just started recording them. We went and lived in this barn for like 2 weeks and recorded with Graham Walsh from Holy Fuck, and made this record, completely finished it, mixed it, and sent it to Sub Pop, the same guy, Chris Jacobs, who didn't write me back for 3 weeks. And I was like, ah, well, you know, it's the only label we sent it to. Nobody else had heard this record except for them. And we're like, all right, well, what are we going to do? Like, I was like, we'll just put it out ourselves, whatever. And then I get this email one night, and it just says, it's like fucking 5 paragraphs long. So I'm just thinking it's like all apologies. Like, the first 3 paragraphs are just these apologies for like not getting back to me, and like, oh, I'm so sorry I haven't had a chance to like write you back, and I really appreciate you sending me this record, blah, 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 blah. And then right at the end, it's like, so we all really love the record here, and we'd love to figure out how we can maybe make this work so we can put it out. And it completely caught... I had to, like, go back and reread it, because it really felt like a rejection letter up until that last point. And so, yeah, that from there, we developed, like, a really good friendship and solid working relationship with those guys. They're really hard workers, and they've done a lot for us as far as bringing our band from being, like, a little local Toronto band, ourselves and doing little mini tours whenever we could, to being like an international band, you know?
Yeah, I mean, I'm kind of like kind of the fair weather type fan, where I got into you only because of the Sub Pop connection, because, you know, through Sub Pop you get into magazines and you get highlighted on blogs and your name started popping up, and I saw Toronto next to Sub Pop.
It's our hometown, right? Like, I mean, I know that if there's another band on Sub Pop from Toronto, I would give them a listen, you know, or a band from Toronto signs to Matador or another, you know, these big labels that I respect, I'll always give those. I mean, I try and listen to as much as I can, but...
But Sub Pop is a label that I really, you know, I mean, I'll check in on once in a while, but as far as, you know, how it used to be in the 90s, how just every single release had to be listened to. Yeah. Because of just how consistent they were at one point. And then they started to branch out, and then they kind of lost a lot of people. I was in that mix.
Yeah, so was I.
But you guys, whether your audience knows it or not, and that's something I was thinking about watching you guys today, do these people watching this band know the genre that these guys are really a part of? And I feel that you guys, along with bands like Piss Jeans, and I could probably name a couple other newer kind of bands, and I hear the term noise rock tagged with you guys. I don't know if you like that term or not.
I'm okay with it. I'm not sure it's totally suitable, but...
But I liken you guys to a lot of the stuff that I heard on Amrette back in the 90s, yeah. Not on Sub Pop. And bands like... JC made a good comment while we were watching you guys, and he said, this is a lot like Yank Crime, Drive Like Jehu, which, honestly, coming from the two of us, it's a big compliment.
Oh, I mean, coming from anybody, that's a compliment. That's still one of my favorite records.
But you guys... Yeah, but you guys... those are influences. You guys are aware. Because I remember someone telling me that Piss Jeans, someone said, oh, you guys kind of sound like Jesus Lizard. And the guys from Piss Jeans hadn't really given the Jesus Lizard a listen. So I'm just wondering if, like, what is your, what's the lineage for you guys, the influences? Is it directly Drive Like Jehu and stuff like that?
No, I actually think that as far as playing goes, I think that Drive Like Jehu are pretty far from being an influence. Our influences come from all three of us listen to, like, we're big music fans. We listen to all sorts of stuff, you mm-hmm. know. Alex is, it feels like recently it's just, he's just constantly listening to the Beatles again. But I think where we all kind of intersected was maybe in like the DC hardcore mm-hmm. or like the SST era hardcore stuff. Mm-hmm. A lot of like Minor Threat or Fugazi or Black Flag,
which were influences of that first crop of, exactly. of 90s noise bands.
I feel like we're pulling probably from the same place where a lot of those guys. I mean, because maybe okay. So Hot Snakes, every time I listen to them, all I can hear is the Wipers, and I love the Wipers, mm-hmm. and I think that Hot Snakes were like they had a very direct Wipers influence,
right?
And so like, you know, I think all those guys were probably pulling from all the things that we grew up on as well, because we're kind of close to the same age as a lot of those guys,
right.
Maybe 6 or 7 years younger, mm-hmm. but still, that's what we grew up on, you know, and that's kind of where we, I mean, I went to Discord a few weeks ago when we were in D.C.
House. I saw the photo.
Did you see that
you,
photo?
with you and Ian MacKay. Like, what's going through your head when you're taking that photo?
I had a moment after that where I was just sort of, I kind of thought about
It's a picture, just for everyone listening, it's a picture of the guys in Mets with Ian MacKay on the steps. That classic Minor Threat photo.
Yeah, and I think when I walked away from that situation, and Ian wasn't, he treated us like a peer. It was really like a really casual conversation and almost like bashfully, like I was like, can we please take a photo with you? He's like, yeah, well, we have to do it on the steps.
So that was his idea?
That was his idea. Because it's right across the street from the Discord warehouse. And so we go over and do this photo, and I'm sitting in the van afterwards just thinking, you know, we did tours with Obits and like Rick Froberg's and like one of my all-time favorite bands. Then we go to Discord to see our friend who runs the he runs Love It Records as well. This guy Brian, he's an amazing guy, and he lets us go in there sometimes and dig through records and buy stuff. And Ian MacKay walks in. I'm like, man, I've met all of my musical idols, and they treat me like a friend, mm-hmm. and like a and it's just, you know, it's a really like it's an amazing thing to be able to like play music and meet the people that you've always looked up to. and realize that they can just be on level with you, you know? And as an adult, it's just, I don't know, it touched me and made me think of how thankful I am for being able to do this.
So do you have that photo framed? Like I would if I...
Not yet. I haven't had a chance. I haven't been home for long enough. I've been home
This happened on this tour, because I still see it recently.
Yeah, so you haven't been home. It was 3 weeks ago. I've been home, but I was only home for 5 days. So, I mean, I haven't had a chance to...
5 days is enough to go to Blacks.
Okay. All right.
Get it printed up and framed.
Yeah, but I want to get it life-size. So.
Oh, no, right. Oh, that's cool. I have run into Ian MacKay once. And we sat down and we had breakfast together.
Yeah.
And it's
real easy going, smart guy.
And yeah. And gave us shit for licensing our record to Universal. Gave me shit for that. Which
did he really?
Well, in a very friendly way.
Sure.
And it was awesome because I was like, oh man, I'm getting reamed out by the man. Yeah, yeah. This is awesome.
But they built something that is super unrealistic for so many bands, you know?
Yeah,
the Fugazi, the
ideal.
Yeah, the Fugazi blueprint is just, it doesn't work for like 99.9% of bands as much as you want it to. It's like,
but that is the standard that you are judged on as a band by everyone else.
Of course, yeah.
And it's frustrating when you're on the other side of the fence. You do ask yourself every day, what would Ian do? That's what I say. And I think me and Damien have talked about that. You know, what would Ian do? Is something in the back of your head.
We played with a band recently that wrote a note to Ian MacKay because their song was getting, like, they had been offered a bunch of money to license the song to a commercial. And they're like, man, Fugazi would never do that.
Yeah.
So they wrote this letter to him, like this is maybe 10 years ago or something. Write this letter being like, man, I don't know what to do. We're really conflicted. And I'm pretty sure Ian wrote back. He's like, if it's something that will make your life easier or something that will make your life better and you can sleep at night, then you go ahead and do it. It's like, it doesn't matter what I did. It matters what you do. And I think that that's really like the point.
You know? You know, it's gotten to the point sometimes while we're in this band that I actually get mad at Ian MacKay, because it's just like, God damn it. Doesn't everyone realize that this happens to 0.05% of bands out there can pull this shit off? We all want to do it,
but
we can't do it.
I'm glad that he did, because you know what? It kind of, when you're setting your goals, if your goals are just basically to like play and put on punk rock shows and have a good time. Steve from Mudhoney, when we were touring with those guys in South America, I had to sit on a panel. It was like a Sub Pop sponsored tour thing down there with us, Obits, and Mudhoney. And Steve gave everybody in the room the best advice I've ever heard. And like, if there's ever a band that ever asked me like what you should do with your band, I will always tell them, play music with your friends, and whatever happens, happens. And at the end of the day, as long as you're playing with your friends, you'll be fine. You can't talk with your friends, you know? It makes those, like, I mean, we live in close quarters at a certain point. If the three of us, like, toured in a van the way that we toured and we hated each other, we would have broken up forever ago. You know, on that first record, I think we played 400 shows. So, like, and in a van, you know? Mm-hmm. In a small van, mostly driving ourselves, just the three of us.
I also wanted to tell you, because I realized earlier today, that you might have been hoodwinked by coming on this show, because the co-host, my co-host, usual co-host, is Nick Flanagan from Wrong Hole.
Oh yeah, I know Nick. I've known Nick for forever.
And whether people know it or not, Wrong Hole recently made some merchandise that I have.
Yeah, I have it too.
Yes, you know.
Yeah, they aped our record cover.
Yeah.
It's awesome.
And they've done that with other bands in the past. So you're in a good company, Crystal Castles and Rush.
Oh,
have you seen the cover of their album?
I haven't seen the Rush one. No. Oh, yeah, yeah.
2012. So you're in good company.
Yeah. Well, Andrew from Wrong Hole gave us our first show ever.
Right.
He was in Quest for Fire. They were releasing their first record, And they kind of forced us out of our practice space to play that show. And that's the first time we had ever played a show.
Wow, okay.
And that was really the beginning of Metz, right?
So there. You got Wrong Hole, there's some sort of Wrong Hole connection.
Well, going even further back, because I was at a Project 9 show and I met Nick Flanagan. I met Nick Flanagan and Andrew Mozinski at that show, and we hung out a ton right while they were working on this zine they were doing called Free. So I've known them since I was like 13 or 14 years old.
Yeah, so were you guys mad at that? I heard you guys were upset.
I wasn't. I thought it was hilarious.
Okay.
Yeah.
No, because that's why I was like, oh, did they? I heard they got upset at that initially, and then you guys.
I'm honored. To be honest, like, if someone's going to, like, if we've gotten to a point where someone feels like, it's going to be noticed if they ape our record cover, that's awesome. I think that's great.
Yeah, I think it's a picture of Nick with his head down.
And it says Metz all over the book that he's on. Yeah.
Yeah. I've got the shirt. They opened for us when we played Danforth.
Yeah.
Like a couple of months ago. And then we got Wrong Hole. Whether people wanted it or not, we got Wrong Hole to open up for us. So. And he usually co-hosts the podcast, obviously not when I'm on the road.
We would have had a deep conversation if Nick were here. We'd go back in time. Do a shout out to Nick's old band Head Cleaner with Andrew.
Oh, I don't even know that.
Yeah, no, because I don't think they ever played a show.
No, I don't know that.
But that was what they were doing when I met them. They're like, yeah, we're in a band. We're called Head Cleaner, and I don't think they ever practiced.
Head Cleaner. No, I just knew. Well, I knew Nick. He was just this kid to us on the scene, and
because your first 7-inch, it was on Teenage USA, right?
No, our first 7-inch was on Sonic Onion.
Okay, I have it. It's like no cover, right?
No cover. It's from 98.
I bought it when it first came out.
Oh, cool.
I think you were working at Sunrise Records at the time.
Yes, I was.
I worked at HMV across the street.
No shit.
Yeah.
Wow, I didn't know that. I didn't. I worked there forever, and I never told anyone I was in a band. And then I was on the cover of I, and I didn't tell. I think some people got mad.
Really?
Because I didn't say anything. I was just working there.
I came to the 7-inch release show. So I've
in Hamilton, or
yeah, in Hamilton.
Oh wow. Okay. So
I'm OG, man.
Wow, man. Holy smokes! You threw out a P9.
I've been around a long time, man. I've been to shows. I used to go to tons of shows.
Do you know Jaime from Project 9?
He's an artist now.
He's in a God's Head Silo album. Nobody knows, on Sub Pop.
Wait, sorry. He's on it. Like, he plays on it?
No, he's in, his photo is in it.
Which album?
I want to say Elephantitis of the Night, but it's the cover is like, it looks like a metal album.
Oh,
and it's a
no,
chariot.
That's,
what is that? You know what I'm talking about.
Yeah, I have that record. It was the last one they ever did.
Yes.
He's in it?
His photo of him playing outside the Rivoli, where God's Head Silo played that night. They played the Rivoli.
Yeah, with Six Finger Satellite. I was at that show.
I was at that show too.
The singer from Six Finger Satellite almost killed me with a microphone stand at that show.
I might have seen that.
Remember how chaotic that band was? Like, they had done like Edge Fest or something like that on the side stage, which is, when you think about it, you think about that band, like, that's super bizarre. But he had one of I think he had his own mic stand and had like a really heavy bass, and he swung it and it came right down in front of my face, like just missing my nose, and cracked on the ground, and he looked panicked because I think he thought he'd clocked me.
Yeah.
And then I went to the back of the room.
Wow, I was at that show. I saw that. I love that band, though. Did you love them?
Six Finger Satellite.
Yeah. Oh,
I still go back to that band. I recently.
Wait a minute. They were on Sub Pop, right?
Yeah, they're a Sub Pop band. They're actually. I put on a show for them at the Garrison like 4 years ago or something like that. Because they put out a new record.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, they put out a new record, but I mean, the last thing I really loved by those guys was that Paranormalized record. I thought it was
What's
great.
What's the cover of that?
It's the four heads in a circle.
Is it the silver one?
No, but that one's amazing. That's the best awesome. One. That's Severe Exposure.
Yeah. It's kind of like Devo, Kraftwerk. They were getting more into that.
Yeah.
I was kind of disappointed when I first heard them after I'd seen
with shellac guitar tones, though. Like, the guy's guitar, like, he's almost Steve Albini-style shellac guitar tone on that.
On the what?
On that Severe Exposure record. It's that guy, the Juan McClain. He's a DJ now.
Oh, I see. Okay.
Yeah, but
Yeah, I love that album. And that 10-inch that came out shortly after.
Machine Cuisine. It's really good, yeah.
We played with them once.
Yeah?
At the Horseshoe.
They're such a cool band.
With Trans Am.
Oh, another one of my favorite bands.
It was us, Trans Am, and Six Finger. How 90s is that, man?
I don't know. Trans Am are still kicking it.
Yeah. I love that the first two albums.
I can't remember the names of the records right now. It's amazing because I just pulled out a whole bunch of Six Finger Satellite stuff just out of nowhere. And now it's like Future World and the Red Line.
What covers that?
Future World's the one that's like, it's white with like the green lines. And then the Red Line's the one with the red face on it. And then, I mean, if you go back further, there's the self-titled one, like the blue one. And then
Pigeon is the most popular bird.
I was talking to Trans Am.
Okay, now I'm getting confused.
Sorry. Surrender to the Night.
Oh, that's Trans Am.
My roommate played that. It was like the first thing I ever heard by those guys. We went to see them play. My roommate was John Drew at the time.
And who's recorded us.
He's recorded us, too.
Yep.
So he played me Surrender to the Night. And you remember there's that one song. And at the end, you just run the whole thing through a distortion pedal.
Mm-hmm.
And you can kind of hear it happening in the background. It's like the most immaculately recorded thing up to this one point. And all of a sudden, it just goes... And, I've been a huge fan of that band ever since then. That's another band, like, you know, the three of us always agree on. Like, we can always listen to Trans Am.
Yeah, the first two is the blue and white.
Self-titled.
And then Surrender.
And then Surveillance.
And then when we played, when Makeup brought us down to D.C., we played Cold Rice.
Cool.
Dudes in Trans Am were in the crowd.
That's awesome.
And I was like, we played together, like, maybe 4 months ago. You guys said boo to us. And then
really?
Yeah, and then the singers, or the front guy was, like, in the front row, like, with his fist in the air and stuff. And I'm like, oh, wow. Well, that's cool. That's great.
Having a bad day, I guess.
Yeah, it was cool. They're a great band. Yeah. I fucking love them. But you came back to Jaime from Project 9. He's in the collage of photos in that God's Head Silo album.
No way.
Playing with a mask and a guitar, and he was in front of the Rivoli, and they took photos and they put it in the album. So there's a Project 9 connection,
which you would never think would happen. No. Really, right?
And you brought up Project 9, so I had to make
they were a band that I would go see in Toronto. And I mean, when I think back, I can't remember what their music sounded like. I think it was really funky.
Yeah, funky.
But
they're all nice guys.
It was just super fun to watch, right?
All like, the dudes I've met in that who were part of it were really nice.
Yeah, they were amazingly nice people and hardworking, but they would always show up with this bag of tricks, right? Like, you remember, you'd go to the show and, like, Jaime would be half naked on, like, a single roller skate with, like, balloons attached to his arms or something like that, and just riding around the stage screaming his head off.
Just some crazy, it
was super fun. There was a whole, like, that Teenage USA thing. There was a lot of, like, good bands on.
Who was on?
Or maybe it was what was Phil's band before, or Phil's label before? It was Skull Geek Records.
And Phil Klego. Was on it?
It was Pecola.
I know Phil.
Yeah, it was Pecola, Secret Agent.
Oh right.
Small Mouth. And, I mean, that's all I got right now.
This is for Turned Out a Punk.
Listen, all I gotta say is that. That city just, like, was just spitting out great bands that maybe never really got their fair...
Do you remember Horseshack?
Absolutely, I remember Horseshack.
Shut up.
Yeah.
Really?
Dude, I went to shows all the time. I saw tons of bands.
You saw Horseshack?
Yes.
Well, that's nice. I'm glad that someone saw us, and now they're still doing it. But it was... that's what I was thinking when I was watching you today. I'm like, you know, Horseshack, we could have played with you guys.
Yeah.
You know, and
did you guys do one of those grasshopper things at the Opera House?
No.
What's that regional, man?
Yeah, let's do it. And I follow Derek Madison on Instagram. No, our biggest claim to fame was the reason why we were a band was opening up for the Jesus Lizard and Girls awesome. Against Boys.
Where was that show?
At the Opera House. Okay. It was at the Opera House. Yeah. Were you at that show?
Yeah, I was at that show. I think I went with my sister.
Yeah, and that, to me, at the time, in 94, was the pinnacle of my life. That was the biggest thing that you could ever do.
Yeah.
And,
fucking huge, man.
And that was great. It. Yeah. But Elliot Lefko, like, I kept bugging him for weeks before the show. And then, like, a few days before the show, he said, okay,
do you want to open for him? And I was like, yeah, but Elliot, all the ads are already in. No one knows. I can't prove this to anybody that we played with the Jesus Lizard.
Yeah.
And then I think Perlick wrote a review,
right,
and I have the clip. And so what happened was recently, there's, it's a club in Toronto, and they have a house band, and the house band's name is Horseshack.
Really?
Yeah, they call themselves Horseshack, and I found this out on Twitter, and I started tweeting the main guy, and I've never met him, and he seems like a nice guy.
Sure.
But I just said, hey, I kind of poked at him, and I said, hey, man, I fucking love you guys. I saw you guys when you opened up for Mule at Sneaky D's.
I was at that show too.
Were you?
Yeah, totally.
No shit.
I knew. What was his name? Lou Klein.
Lou Klein.
Lou Klein, who booked at Sneaky D's, and he used to let Andrew, Nick, and myself into Sneaky D's shows when we were underage. And he would sit us at the bar with a Coke and a plate of nachos, and we could go see any show we wanted. He was like, these guys are on my permanent guest list. And we
How did you get on Lou's good side? Because I didn't think he had a good side.
I have no idea, but for some reason, he allowed us into that place. And, you know, that was where I first met, like, Ron Anisett.
He did sound for us many times.
Yeah, me too. And, I mean, we still see him whenever we play at Lee's Palace. But, yeah, Lou. I, like, saw Killdozer. I saw Mule play there.
Did you see Wool?
I didn't see Wool.
Because we opened for that. We opened that. Okay. And then we broke up right when Lou asked us to open up for The Unsane.
I was at that show, too.
We were supposed to open for The Unsane.
Then Grasshopper did it.
Did they?
Yeah.
I was just like, I don't want to talk to anybody.
Yeah, Grasshopper picked that one up for you.
Oh, fuck. But what was it? So this band, Horseshack, are playing in Toronto. That's the name of my old band. And look, it's my first band that I played clubs with, so I have this kind of real connection with the name.
Sure.
And there's been other bands who have the same name, like there's Ghost in Sweden, and there's Ghost in Japan.
Yeah.
But we're talking about the same name in the same city. And we were not on, we never released anything, but we weren't under the radar either.
Sure.
So I went on Twitter and I
saw you guys at least twice.
Right. There's proof right here.
Yeah, right here.
And so I tweeted the guy and I go, I saw you guys open up for Mule, and I posted the flyer, right, where it shows our name, and then I did it for a couple other shows. You guys were awesome when you opened up for the Luna Checks. And he was like, oh, that's not me, man.
It was Lee's Palace, right?
Yeah. And then he goes, he retweeted me back and he said, no, that wasn't me. That wasn't my band. And I go, that's right, because it was my band. What the fuck are you doing? I must have sent him like 5 tweets. And I did this whole thing. Like, I'm like, look, he's a cool dude. The guy's a nice guy. He doesn't know. But I feel if you're going to have the same name from a band from the same city, that original band gets to make fun of the new band forever.
Yeah, but they can keep the name.
They can keep the name. I said, you can keep the name, but I get to make fun of you forever.
Yeah.
And then he started making fun of me. I didn't get mean-spirited about it. I treated it as a joke, and then a couple other people got involved, and I'm like, okay, listen, guys,
step back.
It's
supposed to be funny.
I really don't give a shit
at
the end of the day. But, and I did say, like, he can use the name, my full blessings, but I get to make fun of him forever.
Sure.
And that's just it. That's just how I feel. So, and I used a cover of a Ghost from Japan, who were on K Records or something. And I used that cover to my full rant.
But dude, you're going so deep. Like, you think that Horseshack from Toronto knows who Ghost Japan are?
No. I know, I'd never expect anyone to remember who Horseshack is. Oh, but that's cool, man. I had no idea that you went that deep.
Shit, I'm sorry, man.
Oh, my God. Anyone
we could go on for hours.
I mean, anyone who's ever seen Horseshack. I mean, it's like our band, like Danko Jones, is just kind of like, yeah, I saw your band. Oh, yeah, get in line. But Horseshack to me is like, I was like, wow, that's super cool, because it's really close to my heart, which is why I did tweet what I did.
But, well, dude, I saw you twice.
Wow. That's super cool.
At least
man.
Twice, yeah.
That's really nice to hear. You know, I never knew anyone was paying attention. And you saw us in those Sneaky D's shows where Lou booked us.
I went to like every Sneaky D's show. Like it was like I had those parents that didn't care where I was going or what I was doing. So I would go out, and I was living in, like with my dad in Scarborough. So
I was living in Scarborough
yeah.
when I was in Horseshack.
So I would take the train to Warden Station.
Yes.
And I would have to walk for an hour to get home from
I
Warden Station.
I did not have to do that.
So I would catch the last subway after the whatever band I saw play, and then I would walk. Because, I mean, I was young. I didn't have any money. I couldn't take a taxi or anything. The buses weren't running. So I would walk. But that's what I did when I was a kid, man. Like
I would take the Warden 68. That brought me.
It was a 69, was it not?
It was 68. Warden 68 got me right to my.
You're going almost. Super regional now. But I did the one Macau 102.
This went so deep.
So
way
far.
Deeper than Nick Flanagan would ever go.
You're going to have to edit the hell out of this.
I want to keep it just so I can piss him off. So do you know Mark Arm?
Yeah.
He seemed like a cool guy when I met him.
Oh, he's an awesome guy. All those Mudhoney guys, they're like a really sweet group of guys. They've seen and been through so much, yeah. You know. But yeah, Mark, I'll credit Mark for being one of the main reasons why we're even on Sub Pop at this point, because we got asked to open for them in Montreal and in Toronto. And I remember seeing him watching us play, and he went back and sort of reported back. He's like, yeah, we played with Mets. You guys need to keep your eye on these guys.
Wow.
So, and I mean, that's a pretty massive, massive pat on the back, you know?
Mm-hmm. I think I don't know too much of the going-ons and Sub Pop, but if Mark Arm gives you the thumbs up, you got a pretty big green light.
We saw them 2 weeks ago in Greece. We've toured with them a lot.
Wow.
And they're amazing people, really nice, down-to-earth, easygoing.
A big influence on this band. And,
yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And, yeah, once again, completely touched with, like, the idea of getting to meet people that you looked up to your whole life. You know?
Absolutely, yeah, just getting... I think I met him through a mutual friend in Seattle, and then he saw us play. And there was one point at the Crocodile Club.
Yeah.
And
I feel like he would love your band.
Well, there's one point where I was doing some banter and shit, and he cracked up. He literally bent over laughing, and I was like, yes! Yes! I was like, I'll never forget that image of Mark Arm, like, yeah. laughing while we were playing, and I was like, fuck! Nobody in this room knows how good this feels,
yeah,
man!
Yeah, totally.
So, and I have the, actually, because they taped the show, or
yeah.
at least they used to, and I have that. I don't know exactly what part.
The venue's amazing,
but,
man.
Yeah, they've redone it, right?
We played there a year ago, and it was really cool. Like I didn't know the history of that venue, but it's got a pretty deep history.
Yeah, I think he showed up to a show in 2005.
Cool.
So I think it was the old room, and then we went there like maybe 3 years ago, and it was revamped, and I think it holds more people now and stuff like that.
Yeah, I think it's like
bigger.
500 people or something.
Yeah,
like that.
Yeah. I mean, all the Seattleites that I've met through music are just really, really. I don't know. I don't know why I get along with them. There's something about.
We feel kinship with
closeness to Canada in a way. I think, you know.
I don't even know what it is, but they just like everybody we know from the Sub Pop label to the bands that we you know, even like the, you know, Piss Jeans, who are not Seattle guys, but they're related to us in like the Sub Pop way. They're friends of ours, really nice guys. And then but the Mudhoney guys are just they've been really cool to us since day one. You know, like Dan Peters was in Nirvana. Like that guy is like the most incredible history, and he is one of the funniest people I've ever met, and one of like the most instantly warm people I've ever had the pleasure to like spend time with.
I've always wanted to meet Steve.
He's got, if you ever want to talk music with someone, Steve will like take you down a road. Like you could do like a 7 or 8 hour podcast with him about like old 7 inches.
See, that's not my podcast. That's Damien's podcast.
Sorry, man. I keep on getting confused about who I'm talking to. You guys look so much alike.
It's funny because we did the podcast with Duff McKagan.
Right.
Me and Damien tag-teamed on Duff. And Damien was pulling out all this shit, and no one saw it, but the look on Duff's face to Damien was like, how the fuck do you know all this shit? So, yeah.
He's a musical historian.
Damien goes deep.
But I think that, you know, maybe Damien and Steve should do a podcast together, but Steve is honestly, like, a really good chat, really smart guy with, like, a intense musical knowledge.
I'd love to hear. Well, that's, I think, who people... Those kinds of people should be on Damien's podcast.
Sure.
The ones who can go really deep. I mean, when I was on Damien's podcast, we went regionally deep.
Sure.
Because he allowed it.
That's what that's what it was like when I was on it.
When were you on it? Why did I miss that?
It was like maybe like an episode or two ago.
Oh, okay. Because
it's pretty recent.
Yeah, the last one I heard was Flanagan.
I've been afraid to listen to it, to be honest.
Yours?
Yeah, because I like went deep. Like, I had not gone that deep in a very long time. So I was like bringing up stuff that I had forgotten. Like,
deeper than what we just went through just now?
If you put the two together, I think you'd have, like, a really good idea of exactly who I am.
So this might be...
This will be for my eulogy, right?
Yeah, side B of the Turned Out a Punk episode.
We'll do a cassette. We could do a set. We could do, like, a seven-sided, like, record.
Yeah, like a compact disc.
There's no side B on a compact disc, man.
You know what? Lately, with the vinyl resurgence, I'm a big compact disc fan.
Are you really? Do you buy compact discs?
I do.
Really?
I do.
You're like the only one. I'll give you a compact disc after this of our new record.
Whether you give me a compact disc or vinyl, I'm fine with either one.
Okay.
Like, a lot of people are now just insistent on records or vinyl, and I'm like, well, there's pluses and minuses for both, and I just want to hear the music.
Yeah.
I really don't care.
I find with vinyl, though, like, you know, we sell more vinyl than we sell anything else.
Yeah.
But you get a download card with it, so I got a feeling, like, these things go home, they might get listened to, like, twice as an LP, but probably, like, 100 times as, like, the digital download.
See, that's what I mean, is, yeah. You know, when we put out Fire Music, I don't think there was a download link on a few of those first releases, and people were like, where's the download link? And I was like, well, when I bought records when I was young, I didn't have a download link.
Drag City.
We listened to those fucking...
I don't think Drag City do it. I bought the new Bill Callahan record. No download.
And I am for that.
I'm okay with it as well.
I'm okay with it.
But then I bought it on iTunes so I can listen to it in my car as well. So
that is a hardcore move.
So,
and I have done stuff like that with other albums too, where you're just like, yeah.
I just really wanted to hear it.
Yeah,
that's all. You know?
I want to hear it on the subway or on a plane.
Yeah, and you can't really just
or walking down the street.
Player.
No, and that was the argument that people were giving me. Like, look, I want to walk. I want to take a walk and listen to your record. I did buy your record on iTunes, by the way.
Thank you very much.
But then I wrote a thing on, you know, here. I mentioned your name here and here. And, you know, so it does kind of, and I'm sure someone read that and they went to see you play. And it's happened to me for other people.
There's tons of benefits. I'd say there's more positives than negatives. I mean, bands don't make money from making records. And I mean, fuck, bands don't really make money a lot of the time, you know? If you're lucky enough to be able to, like, go on tour and come home and not have to go back to a 9-to-5, then I think you're doing all right.
Yeah, that to me is being a successful band.
Yeah.
That's a different
thing. And so I'm thankful enough for that.
Cool. Well, Chris, should we end it like this?
I think so.
I think I gotta go see Lagwagon and Millencolin.
Are they label mates of yours? Millencolin is, no?
Joey K from Lagwagon he put out a solo album on Bad Taste. And Mill and Colin were on Burning Heart while we were on Bad Taste. So
that confused me.
Two Swedish punk rock labels side to side, but we're all friends. It's all good. And Eric lent me his guitar today.
That's awesome.
So it was cool. Yeah.
Well, that was fun. Thanks a lot for having me.
Thanks, Chris. I'm glad you were able to sit down and
get regional.
Thanks, man.
Thank you very much.